Welcome to Humanize from Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism, where human rights meet human responsibilities. We speak with writers, thinkers, and newsmakers on the controversial issues of human life and human thriving that impact our daily lives. We are exceptional as creatures in the cosmos, as equal members of the human family, and as ethical beings. Humanize explores some of the fundamental questions. How do we thrive? How do we live well and care for what we've inherited? How do we act responsibly with one another and in the wider world? And how do we conserve the good things of this life for the future? We matter. Our actions matter. Let's get into it. I'm Wesley J. Smith, and this is Humanize. Most people support responsible environmental policies, but may be unaware of how radical, my characterization, the leading edge of the movement has become, as an increasing number of activists support granting rights to nature. Is nature rights a subversive threat to human exceptionalism and our thriving, as I believe, or is it the next necessary step in society's moral growth and key to preventing a catastrophic environmental collapse, as its adherents claim? Let's find out. My guest is one of the primary founders of the Nature Rights Approach. Thomas Allen Lindsay serves as senior legal counsel for the Center for Democratic and Environmental Rights, an organization committed to globally advancing the legal rights of nature and environmental rights. He is the co-founder of the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund and is widely recognized as the founder of the contemporary community rights and rights of nature movements. Lindsay is a cum laude graduate of Widener Law School and a three-time recipient of the law school's Public Interest Law Award. He is a co-founder of the Daniel Pennock Democracy School, now taught in 24 states across the country, which has graduated over 5,000 lawyers, activists, and municipal officials, which assist groups to create new community campaigns which elevate the rights of those communities over rights claimed by corporations. Lindsay is the author or co-author of several books on community activism and civil disobedience. He assisted the Ecuadorian Constitutional Assembly in 2008 to adopt the world's first constitution recognizing the independently enforceable rights of ecosystems and is a frequent lecturer at conferences across the country. I'm most pleased he agreed to join us on the podcast, during which we will have a discussion, not an argument. Thomas, welcome to Humanize.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Wesley. Good to see you again.
You're a lawyer and a committed political and environmental activist. What got you interested in pursuing that as your life's journey?
Yeah, so I think mostly it was about frustration. Coming out of law school, I had framed the problem as not enough lawyers doing environmental law. So we all look out of our windows and we see kind of this declining state of nature, whether it's climate change or, you know, toxic waste being dumped or recent news around the Great Barrier Reef in Australia, which is now experiencing 75% bleaching from these climate events. And so looking out the window, I said to myself, well, things are getting worse. It can't possibly be the environmental laws that we have in the U.S. because they're the best in the world, or at least we're taught. And that the problem was really a shortage of environmental lawyers who were doing the work, because if the problem wasn't the laws themselves, the problem must be enforcement and not enough people doing enforcement. And I think I was as shocked then, 30 years ago, as a young law student, as I am now by the number of public interest environmental lawyers in the U.S. There are only 200 full-time public interest environmental lawyers in the U.S. And so kind of frame the problem is not enough lawyers doing enforcement work of those environmental laws. And so right out of law school, even though I was told I was crazy by the dean who said it was crazy to create a law firm right out of law school, that's exactly what we did. And instead of charging people for services, we decided to give free environmental legal advice to communities who were fighting things like toxic waste landfills and factory hog farms and other unwanted kinds of development that was coming into their communities. And for about 10 years, I did that traditional conventional environmental law and was very frustrated by the obstacles set up to local communities actually trying to protect themselves of being overridden by things like corporations coming in with certain rights that overrode the rights of those local communities and their ability to say no in those places. And so I think we switch gears because of those 10 years of frustration trying to make things like the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act and the National Environmental Policy Act, actually trying to make those work. And I guess at the end of that process, where we felt that frustration the most, was really that the problem is not that there aren't enough lawyers to enforce environmental laws. The problem is the environmental laws themselves, which really don't have a place at the table for communities themselves or for the ecosystems that ostensibly those environmental laws are supposed to protect.
I think a lot of our listeners might question that because the environmental movement has a great deal of power. There's a lot of money that's poured into the environmental movement. You've got organizations like the Sierra Club and others. The idea that, and I acknowledge, you know, I've written books with Ralph Nader, so I acknowledge the power of corporations. But the idea that the environmental movement is somehow stunted and unable to exert its will in a democratic society seems a stretch to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's what we're here today to talk about, which is that after billions of dollars being dumped into environmental organizations and thousands of those organizations coming into existence over the past 40 years, that by almost every major environmental statistic that we have today, things are worse now than they were before the major environmental laws were passed 40 years ago. And sometimes in my audience, somebody will put their hand up and say, well, Mr. Lindsay, that's not true. It's rivers don't catch on fire anymore. Because, of course, in Ohio, rivers are catching on fire. It's one of the reasons for some of the Clean Water Act and other associated legislation. To which I'll say, well, if that's our metric, you know, that rivers aren't catching on fire anymore, then we've got a real problem. But the fact is that 40 years ago, the people that gave birth to these environmental laws, like Professor Oliver Hauck from Tulane University wrote the Clean Water Act. I think people thought we would be in a much different place now 40 years from then than we are. And in fact, the statistics are really stark. 40% of waterways still don't even come up to the minimum water standards set in the Clean Water Act, for example. So we've got real problems, whether it's climate change, whether it's water pollution, whether it's the fact that we still dump 570 billion pounds of municipal waste into landfills each year. The environmental laws aren't working. And in fact, we would go as far to say that the environmental laws were really never intended to work to protect the environment. And that was part of our frustration, was trying to use these tools that were never really intended to protect communities or the environment. As weird as it sounds, we came to a conclusion that the environmental laws really don't protect the environment.
Well, you know, I'm not going to argue about that right now because I would rather somebody with more expertise in that than me engage you. In fact, I may do that next year on a show. Maybe I'll have somebody who believes in the environmental laws discuss that with you. But I can say that I grew up in Los Angeles in the 50s. The air was so foul, you couldn't even see the San Gabriel Mountains that were 10 miles away. And of course, that's been materially improved, and it was materially improved primarily by taking lead out of gasoline. So certainly, you have to say that some environmental laws work.
Yeah, and phasing out DDT, phasing out lead, phasing out CFCs for the hole in the ozone layer. I mean, all those things are good. But the question really is, are the environmental laws getting us to a place where we're not kind of what the U.S., the U.N. Secretary General said yesterday, we're in a suicidal war with nature at this point? That, in fact, does the only question we should be asking is, does the status of those environmental laws, will they allow us continued habitation on this planet in a quality of life and sustainability that we desperately need here? And so that's really the question. Some, when we say almost by almost every major environmental statistic, doesn't include things like indoor air quality, which of course has greatly benefited from the Clean Air Act and those types of things. But the question is, are they commensurate to the time in which we live? And the answer.
So rather than saying that they didn't work or they don't work, you're saying they're inadequate to the threat that you perceive that we face.
Yeah, I think when we use the word work, are they working or not? Or do they actually guarantee continued survival for not only us, but other species on the planet and the planet itself?
So would you acknowledge that you're a radical? I mean, you know, we've met virtually. We haven't met in person. And you seem the antithesis of a radical in your demeanor. And if so, what does that mean to you?
Yeah, I would say we're both on the radical edge. radical, I think the Latin meaning is at its base or at its root. And I think that we are in a situation where the U.S. system of governance, the system of government that we have, which accords corporations certain constitutional rights, for example, and elevates certain property and commerce rights structurally above rights of communities and self-government, that we have a system of government that's basically a suicide pact, that we come to a place where allowed to play itself out, which it is now, we are in a severe environmental crisis of our own making. And if there's one lesson, you know, that we're consistently taught is that you shouldn't crap where you eat, but that's what we've been doing for the past 100 years. And so, you know, it really comes down to our faith in whether the human race is capable of voluntarily constraining ourselves away from thinking that endless economic production is possible. That myth about endless economic production is basically what's put us in this place of degrading our own life support systems to the point where they may not be able to support us in the decades ahead.
You helped create the Nature Rights Movement, which I have to admit is kind of a breathtakingly audacious thrust of policy. Why do you think nature should have enforceable rights?
Yeah, so I think when people start thinking about the rights of nature concept, sometimes they come at it abstractly or academically at this 40,000-foot level about nature having rights. Yeah, I think it becomes much more practical to them when they think about their river having rights, the one that they live next to, or a forest, or mountains, that type of thing. But the fact is, indigenous people in the U.S. and globally, in fact, have always thought about nature as something other than property. Today, nature is property. If you or I own a 5-acre parcel of land, we have the deed to that piece of property. It carries with it a bundle of rights, and as we all learn in law school, and the bundle of rights include things like the right to destroy that parcel of land. Nature is property. It's something to be owned under our system. My favorite quote is Sir Francis Bacon, who once said that the goal of Western civilization was to torture nature on a rack to extract. That kind of thing has a real contrast to how indigenous people see nature, which is not as property. They see nature as a relative, as a living being. The Anishinaabe people in Minnesota talk about the flying people and the swimming people and the singing people, you know, the birds and the fish as being alive and as relatives. I try to hold Sir Francis Bacon in one hand and indigenous tribal beliefs in the other, and I can't do it because there's such a disjunction between the two.
I think why should we emulate indigenous people? They were pre-industrial. I'm not putting down indigenous people by any stretch. I'm actually 1/16 Native American. So, you know, I'm not going against my forebears, but they were pre-industrial. They didn't have the concept of property, but that doesn't mean they lived in this incredible ideal utopia. Their Native Americans used to drive bison off cliffs. The Aztecs engaged in human sacrifice. So why should we emulate, especially in a world with almost 8 billion people, why should we emulate indigenous people?
Yeah, I think it's because they found a way to live that was not destructive of the natural environment on which they depended.
So, yeah, but they lived to age 50.
Well, so did white Europeans who's...
Right, until industrialization.
Right. I'm not sure we should measure everything productive by the terms of the human lifespan in some ways, but that's another conversation. So indigenous peoples have been able to live without destroying their own life support systems. I mean, when they were driving bison There's a difference between driving bison off a cliff for food and for clothing purposes than for Western Europeans to go into the Great Plains and massacre millions of bison until we had, I think, 12 left. So there's a big difference, I think, between the two. But those indigenous tribal systems are all about, you know, seven generations down the road. What are we doing now that's going to have an impact seven generations down the road? And they treated nature very differently than Western European culture tends to treat nature. So again, one is property, one is not. But I think there are some lessons learned there, which is that those indigenous value systems can be driven into that Western value system to change it, because there's a growing number of people that believe that Western European civilization's culture is one of the reasons why that we are killing the planet. And that, in my opinion, at least, is what's happening right now. And so the rights of nature is really about taking those indigenous value systems and forcing them into a Western civilization legal context. And it is recognizing this concept that ecosystems have rights, similar to human rights. So we talk about human rights as the highest form of legal protection within the law for certain values that we hold special to humans. This is about raising into kind of constitutional law the protections that we have for nature and really exceeding or expanding or accelerating the protections that are already allocated to nature under those conventional traditional environmental laws. So kind of a meshing of those two systems.
Let's be specific. What are the rights of nature?
Well, it depends on who passes the law recognizing those rights. So it can range from a simple right to life, a right to exist. So a river's right to flow, a river's right to be clean, a river's right to produce clean drinking water to native flora and fauna, rights of pollinators. We're working on a rights of pollinators law now, which would recognize pollinator populations as having some legally enforceable rights. And so, you know,
you're talking about bees and wasps and
bees and wasps and the things that contribute $300 billion to our agricultural industry each year, because the pollinators are the reasons why we have food to eat. And so the question is, how do we take this inadequate environmental protective structure that we have today and actually change it, morph it, so that it more resembles the human rights kind of protections that we do under the constitutional structure today than this statutory protection for environmental values? And I have to say, even in a human rights context, it's not like you or I trust government not to violate our free speech rights. So we could have a system of government in which we just have faith that government's not going to violate our right to free speech, but we don't have that system. We don't believe that government is capable of living with that social contract. So what we did was we embedded rights into the Constitution that actually guarantee our ability to sue the government and hold the government responsible if the government violates our free speech rights. No such mechanism exists in the law today for nature, primarily because those environmental laws are focused on human use of the environment. So when we talk about the Clean Water Act, we're talking about fishable and swimmable water is the standard use in the Clean Water Act. That's really about human use. It's anthropocentric. And so the question is, how do we transform that into something that's similar to the high level of protections that we currently afford to humans?
Well, we could talk for 2 hours about what you just said, but let's just real quickly say, if the river has the right to flow, that means we don't have the right to dam it, which will kill hydroelectric projects. It will kill flood control. So the river would be able to flow, would be able to flood, and we would just have to live with that rather than have any dams or other constraints on that free flow.
Yeah, so the short answer to that is yes.
Wouldn't that put us back tremendously? Wouldn't that leave many of our areas of life uninhabitable? Wouldn't that, in terms of global warming, wouldn't that harm the planet in terms of emissions and so forth?
Yes, I said the short answer was yes. I'll get to the long one in a second. But the short answer is we're already doing, those dams do tremendous damage. I mean, you're familiar with the situation in the Pacific Northwest where the salmon runs have now gone down to zero because the dams impede passage of salmon past those physical dam barriers. So whether it's that or federal government subsidies for development that's done in floodplains, where now insurance companies are starting to pull out, so not insure people who are in dangerously environmental areas like floodplains. We've really decided to ourselves that we don't have to follow any of these kinds of natural laws in the U.S., that we're going to do what we want to do wherever we want to do it. And that comes with costs on the back end. And that's what we're experiencing now. So instead of a 0-to-1 comparison, it's really the fact that we're incurring costs now by doing what we're doing. It's actually dam removal is a way of in some ways, taking care of those costs while restoring the natural environment back to a place where we can use it for other reasons and in other ways. Like hydro, for example, the way Western civilization does hydro is these huge hydro plants that come in, block the entire river. That's how we use them for power. But there's a whole new generation of hydro that's emerging that is not about blocking the river. That's about partial hydro and using other means to harness water power. All those things that play into climate change, you know, kind of harnessing that kind of sustainable, kind of environmentally sensitive hydroelectric power in those places that would do that kind of work. So I think we're not talking all or nothing. We're talking about how do you have a river having rights that need to be respected enough so that it changes the way humans decide to develop that power source?
Well, it would also mean no irrigation for farmers, wouldn't it?
Well, it means changing what we do. Right now, if we talk about irrigation for farmers, you have farmers in the Pacific Northwest that are now trying to out-drill each other to get into the aquifer, which has now been depleted over the past 40 years. And there are some places that use the Colorado River, for example, that are now being forced to cut back as well. We're almost on the edge of using everything we can, and now there's a cost coming back to us for that. So even if you're not in the nature is sacred, you know, we the crystal gazing, tree hugging kind of nature is some kind of God in that camp. Even if you take a more nuanced view, it, in some ways, it's about saving ourselves because we've put ourselves in a situation where we have a debt now to pay back. And this is one way to pay that debt back. But whether it's over drilling for water, there are cities now running out of water. Mexico City is now being forced to ration because their water levels are at an all-time low. That's a kind of thing to come for us, I think. And so looking at that scarcity model, the question is, how do we change our own governance to attain something different?
My understanding of most nature rights laws is that anybody is given legal standing in court to sue to protect the rights of nature, which means that each and every one of us has the capacity to sue based on our own view of what a particular nature right would be. Wouldn't that throw courts into chaos?
Well, it hasn't yet.
Because it hasn't been really enacted widely.
Well, they've been enacted pretty widely. We have 36 municipalities in the U.S. now, including Orange County, which is 1.5 million people in the city of Pittsburgh, and 8 Indian tribes and 11 countries have adopted something similar. So to answer your question, in Ecuador, where the litigation has been hot and heavy, so you had a bunch, you know, Ecuador, first country to put rights of nature into their national constitution, big deal, first place. There were a lot of lawsuits brought. The Vilcabamba River lawsuit in 2011 and a dozen, 15, 20 others have been filed. Pretty sparse in the way that they've been used. So this kind of court chaos hasn't happened there, even though it's in the national constitution, and even though it authorizes anyone to bring an action in the name of a specific ecosystem. Hasn't been a rush to the court doors, but the cases that have been selected have been very powerful. So whether it's stopping a local government from dumping road debris in a river that was changing its flow, or a cloud forest that successfully overturned a bunch of mining permits that have been issued in that cloud forest. Been very successful in Ecuador. And in fact, aside from court chaos from passing written law, you've had in India, Colombia, and Bangladesh courts, judges on their own, grabbing this concept of rights of nature and pulling it into their courtrooms and actually applying it on their own without any written law whatsoever. So even without the passage of written laws, you have judges now recognizing the value of this, even calling rights of nature the predominant emerging new form of environmental law in the world, that grabbing this stuff into courts and judicial activism happening where they're actually applying this to individual cases. So I don't think there's chaos in the courts. I do think that these laws differ from place to place. Some recognize everybody as having a right to sue. Others recognize only environmental groups as having a right to sue.
Of course.
Right. Other places recognize tribal members, indigenous, because tribal governments have passed some of these laws. So tribal members are suing. But I think the important takeaway here is that the drafters of the law have the power to decide what scope of standing is used within those laws, about how broad you want them or how narrow. I happen to be an advocate for very broad standing because I happen to think what good is the law unless you have a maximum number of people who can actually enforce the law. And that's the opposite direction from the citizen suit provisions that are contained in the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, which the Supreme Court has cut down to almost nothing. So unless you have a property interest in protecting a certain ecosystem, generally the courts won't allow you in. So these laws are different. They're about the community, in fact, being the expert and releasing individual people to be litigants in the cases where they feel that they have the resources to move forward with that kind of case.
You know, one of the municipalities that passed this was Santa Monica. And I grew up in Los Angeles. I know Santa Monica like the back of my hand. There's no nature left in Santa Monica except the mackerel under the pier. So wasn't that more or less an ideological statement of saying that humans are just another animal in the forest?
Yeah, it's funny. You and I don't have that much in common, but we have that in common, which I was the one that said there's no nature left in Santa Monica when they started working on that. It turns out, of course, there is nature left in Santa Monica. I mean, the air and the water and the sand and the ocean and everything else. We didn't work directly on that law, but I think that was kind of, and it hasn't been used. So I think that shows where it came from. But a lot of people have this...
But let's talk about Santa Monica for just a second. Most of these laws don't have grandfather clauses. And if, let's say, California passed a nature rights law, what would stop anyone from bringing a lawsuit against Santa Monica to say you have to restore this area of the beach and of the coastal community to its natural state as it was before people settled there?
Yeah, so part of me likes that.
Of course you do.
The right of restoration, which has been written into some of these laws as well. But most of them, at least the ones we write, are based on an ongoing violation of the rights. So an ongoing violation of the right to flow, for example, or ongoing violation of something else, or a new violation. And as we both know, because we had this conversation at Gonzaga a number of years ago, that the reason why these laws are passing is that communities have been left with what they feel are no other options. That they're passing it generally to deal with a specific project that's coming in, a specific proposal that's coming in. And because of that, the laws are really geared towards that particular thing. It's really difficult outside of Santa Monica for people to think, hey, let's put this kind of effort in to pass a law, which is not easy. Passing a law is not easy. To actually deal with something abstract that might come down the road, but we haven't seen yet. That's very difficult to do. And in my mind, there's only, in the U.S. at least, one place that has passed it out of that generalized, hey, isn't rights of nature cool, rather than dealing with a specific issue, and that was Santa Monica.
Well, a lot of these are aimed at trying to prevent fracking and so forth at the municipal level. Four states so far have basically outlawed nature rights. So it's Utah, Florida, Ohio, and Idaho. Florida and Ohio did because municipalities, or and in Florida's case, I'm sorry, a county, passed a nature rights law. Utah, they were talking about granting rights to the Great Salt Lake. And so Utah passed a law that, which I support completely. I think that the Congress and all states should pass a law that says no non-human animal or non-human association has any rights nor legal standing in the courts. What do you think of that kind of remedy from my perspective?
Yeah, so I think that gives rise to a conversation about what the legal authority of states should be in doing preemptive legislation. I think taking it out of the rights of nature field just for a second to the other ways in which preemption has been used by state governments is an interesting conversation to have. So in Florida, local governments passed like bans on styrofoam, which is generally seen as being bad for the natural environment. The state government stepped in and prohibited those communities from enforcing those bans on styrofoam. Key West, where I've spent some time, there was a group that passed a law by the ballot, so 60-70% of the vote in that particular area, that banned big cruise ships from coming in because of the damage that the big cruise ships were doing to the communities and to the natural environment. That, too, was overridden by the state legislature. Things like rent control, minimum wage increases, basically you name it, a gamut of different issues that state legislatures on a whim have the recognized legal authority under our current system of law to override. And the question to me is, how is that democratic? How is preemption as a doctrine democratic? And the issue is it isn't, because you have a small number of people in the state legislature overturning the lawmaking power at the local level, even when that lawmaking power is aimed at protecting health, safety, and welfare of people.
But hasn't the, like Ecuador's law, prevented locals from perhaps exploiting their resources in a way that they might wish?
Yes, very much so. But we have to distinguish between, I think, property use and extraction from democratic rights of self-governance aimed at protecting health, safety, and welfare. So to us, those are two different things. One is property ownership and use and controls on how that's done. The other one is control of how people decide to protect their own health, safety, and welfare at the local level.
Panama used its nature rights law to prevent a copper mine, as I recall recently. And okay, people applauded that, but I was thinking, what about the miners who don't have jobs that they would have otherwise had? What about copper is an important mineral. If we can never mine copper because of the rights of nature, what's going to happen to our electrical grids, for example, that use copper in wires and so forth? I mean, can't you see where this would lead to a real throttling of human economies?
Well, I thought humans were so exceptional that we could work around those things.
Well, not if you put, we are exceptional, but not if you put handcuffs on everything.
And maybe we can do copper mining in a different way than the lowest common denominator of copper mining that's done today. So I mean, the conversation has all kinds of caveats and exceptions to those things. But yes, we are looking one way or the other at a wholesale disruption of how human societies operate because of the state of the natural environment. And most of that's driven by the fact that development currently is done at the lowest common denominator. It's done whatever maximum production will allow.
Let me just say right here, I really appreciate your candor, because a lot of times, you know, people who are promoting really new radical or novel approaches will say, well, it's really just going to be this tiny little impact. There won't be a change at all. Actually, it would be a huge change, which you just acknowledged.
Yes. And in fact, I expected to end up in one of your op-eds at some point. But it is a massive change in the way that human societies operate. It, just like industrialization was a massive change in the way that people operate. Industrialization put people out of work as well. The shoemaker,
well, that's what the Luddites were about, right?
Right, exactly. The shoemakers and other people put them out of business because it brought in a mass scale. And today we're talking about AI, artificial intelligence, which most people are not being honest about, but it's about replacing people as workers to achieve a higher degree of productivity. These shifts come all the time. They're just basically always driven by the economic forces that want to pare down the cost of economic production. What we're talking about here is what I love about the rights of nature as a concept is I think it's one of the few concepts that has the capability of, sometimes I say it, sometimes I don't, but saving the human race from itself. Because we are in this kind of suicidal race at this point. We're like three-year-olds. The human race is like three-year-olds. Three-year-olds will play with something until it breaks. And then somebody has to pick up the pieces and try to put it back together again. We're kind of still in that three-year-old place where we have been breaking things left and right. We don't understand the value of something until it's broken and we're deprived of it. And then we have to come back and fix it and find a way to make money to actually fix it. That's kind of the human race in a nutshell, at least from my perspective.
How would disputes be settled? I mean, if you go into court, let's say suing for the right of a river to flow, and you're suing, let's say, a large farm that uses that water for irrigation. I'm just taking a quick example. And the farmer can show the large farm, hey, look, if I can't irrigate, that means there are going to, an awful lot of food for human beings is not going to be grown because I can't irrigate the field because the river has a right to flow. And then the nature rights people would say, well, if you irrigate the field, you're going to hurt the guppies and you're going to hurt the salmon and so forth. How would, under a nature rights paradigm, those conflicts be resolved?
Well, just like conflicts between competing constitutional rights between humans are resolved, that's how these disputes would be resolved. And I'm sure using some of the same guidelines that guide those disputes between constitutional rights when they collide. And some of those collision points are corporate rights versus people's rights. When a corporation comes in and says, we're putting in that mine, and the community says, no, you're not. And then the corporation overrides the community with the assertion of corporate constitutional rights that are elevated above those rights of the community. So those disputes are satisfied all the time. I happen to think that the courts are a great place to resolve those disputes, because instead of feeding a ticker tape into an AI machine and having an answer come out the other side, you have real living, breathing humans that are making decisions about what that balance should be. The difference between that scenario and what happens now is stark. Nature doesn't appear anywhere at this point. Nature is invisible to that negotiation process. It doesn't exist. It's like women in the 1860s who were not persons, or African Americans prior to the Civil War as being slaves and weren't persons. They weren't seen by the system.
Was wrong because those were human beings and they're clearly equal to all other human beings. Nature includes mosquitoes. It includes granite outcroppings. It includes oceans. It includes everything. And there is a huge distinction. And even with corporations, you're talking about human juridical entities and associations. It seems to me that rights belong exclusively in the human realm. And then in terms of protecting the environment, we have duties as human beings. And having environmental laws is important. And we can argue back and forth about costs, benefits, harms, and so forth. A good example, I think, is the Endangered Species Act, which has protected many species and also has the nuance that if a species ceases to be endangered, then you can put it under a different category to allow human thriving. What I'm really worried about with nature rights is you're really going to throttle human thriving and human freedom in a utopian cause of creating this pristine world that can't exist with 8 billion people here on the planet.
Yeah, so there's all kinds of good little taking off points in what you just said. One is the Endangered Species Act, just to come at it from that last comment. The Endangered Species Act is funny because it does recognize kind of quasi-rights for species to exist. The only problem is it only recognizes those rights when there's only like three left. So we get, small.
But it's been success. It's been successful. Wolves have been brought back. The bald eagle has been protected.
Eagles, yes, and DDT and the shells and the peregrine falcons, all kinds of things. Those tend to be kind of high romantic species or sexy kind of species. Right now, as we sit, there are a million species that are in threat or threatened with extinction right now in the world. And so things like the Endangered Species Act have limited utility. And in fact, leaving aside the practical realities of what's in the Endangered Species Act, unfortunately, it's subject to governmental whim. So whether it's the current president or Congress, the Endangered Species Act is only as good as the current Congress wants to make it, because the current Congress can, of course, change it. So nature and species really don't have rights under that, because it can change constantly as to what those protections mean.
Right. They shouldn't have rights, but we have responsibilities.
Right. And this gets to the core, our core disagreement, which is that this concept that humans are the only ones capable of having rights. And I think that that's more of like a religious argument that posited somewhere else rather than in kind of a legal discourse, because there's nothing that constrains rights from being conferred on anything else other than humans. There's no, you can't go to like 42 United States Code and find a provision that says rights are only for people. Doesn't exist in the law. And so, you know, when you say, you know, we should trust, part of our duties are to protect nature, and that therefore we should have a responsibility to protect nature. That's part of our duty to protect nature. We don't need rights to do that. From a Machiavellian kind of legal argument perspective, we don't need rights. We can just have responsibilities and duties. The problem with that is that we're not living up to that. Where the duties that we think we have, they're not being carried out, because the status of the natural environment is degrading, and we've degraded it to such an extent. The argument on corporations that you raised is an interesting one, because corporate rights, because people always say this, you know, nature should have rights because corporations have rights. It's not the people within the corporation that have rights. You know, folks, oh, and like what you said, it's a human construct, and humans are rightfully have rights, but with a corporation, it's the property that is the corporation that has rights under our system of law. It's the actual charter of incorporation. It's a piece of property you can buy and sell, but it's the corporation itself that has rights as property. It's not the humans that have rights by virtue of being managers or on the board of directors. It's actually this system has given corporations as a property piece rights under the law. That's a real problem. For our purposes, I guess it's a good thing, because we can say corporations have rights, corporations are property. Well, what we're attempting to do is recognize rights for nature, which is a living entity.
But at least corporations have duties and obligations. You cannot force nature to have responsibilities or duties, because that's beyond the capacity of any aspect of nature except human beings.
Yes, and we don't want nature having duties.
Well, actually, there was a law proposed in Florida that gave rivers obligations, which was ridiculous.
Yes, we couldn't agree more. But so rights in a purely kind of 18th century concept were about duties accompanying those rights. But when rights are recognized on behalf of nature, talking about nature having rights or duties is just ridiculous. I mean, yes. It's almost like saying a river should have free speech rights. It doesn't hold.
Of course.
A river should have due process or equal protection rights. It doesn't hold, because a river is a different kind of substantive entity than a human being. And so when a river has certain rights, it's not being a person, which is sometimes talked about loosely. You know, this is about making a river a person. No, it's not. It's about recognizing that river should have some degree of protection that exceeds the statutes that have been passed to actually protect it in the past, and that we have a model with human rights in which those values have been elevated to the highest levels of protection within society that are commonly agreed on. And I happen to think that communities are exceptional. When you're talking about human exceptionalism, communities are exceptional and should be accorded the degree of latitude to do whatever they think is necessary to protect their own health, safety, and welfare at the community level.
Well, it seems to me you're speaking out of both sides of your mouth. On one hand, you say the local communities should be able to do this. And then on the other hand, you're saying, well, if we can get the larger community, if you will, even at the nation state level, and I assume you'd also support a nature rights law at the international level, then that should be applied.
I think we have a more nuanced view of that, which is that when those laws are passed, they should be treated as a floor, not as a ceiling. right now, when state governments come in to preempt laws, they're treated as having the authority to disperse everything, to preempt everything within a specific area. I happen to think that if the federal government passed something saying, for example, only 10 parts per million of mercury should be allowed in waterways at any time, and a community says, we want to only allow 6 parts per million of mercury to be put into waterways in our community, that the community should be allowed to do that. Because the federal law should be a floor, not a ceiling. But right now, the way that the law treats it, the law treats that federal law as a ceiling, not as a floor. So I think this all fits under that legal argument, at least, that communities should have the power to pass more protective standards than those which have been passed at the federal or state level.
Well, that would lead to real problems with interstate commerce and so forth that we don't have time to get into. But human beings are part of nature, right?
That's a very interesting question. Western civilization has attempted to put itself outside of nature as a construct. So sometimes when I'm asked that question, there's a difference in how you answer it when you say, are indigenous peoples part of nature versus Western civilization part of nature? I happen to think that Western civilization has done a really good job of putting ourselves outside of nature, or outside the natural environment.
And it has created greater prosperity and freedom than any other time in human history, hasn't it? I mean, just in honesty, you have to acknowledge that.
Well, the question is, at what expense? That's the real question. Have we bought ourselves ramped up time, and now we're about ready to pay for that? Has Western European civilization been able to advance in ways that it would not have been able to due to that industrialization? Absolutely, yes. But the question is, at what cost?
And if are you advocating basically deindustrialization?
I'm not sure what that word means, but I think that the direction we're headed, whether it's robots replacing people on assembly lines or artificial intelligence replacing people in all kinds of work, displacing them across the way, we have some real tough questions to ask ourselves about what being a human means in this system. When everybody's treating it as inevitable that, for example, artificial intelligence is going to take out large swaths of the workforce, and a lot of that workforce aren't really trained or prepared or educated to do other things. And so,
well, that's been the history. That's been the history of industrialization, and new things come along, new technologies and so forth. And people don't make the old cliche, the buggy whip anymore, but they, you know, were making Ford Model A's. So that's always going to be happening. But if you make it so that, not only do you have that paradigm, which can be very disruptive without question, but you also have the paradigm of just about anybody on the planet being able to try to prevent a use of resources or a project that they believe violates some aspect of nature's rights. I don't see how you can have any kind of an organized economy.
Well, I think there are some trade-offs that you have to make. There's a lot of economic production that can be done that doesn't violate a river's right to flow, for example, or a mountain's right to exist, or a forest's right to exist. But inevitably, you're talking about thinking about what a different kind of economic production would look like, changing the way that people do things, like make clothes and travel and grow food. All those basic things that we do today, there's a cost to all of that. And we're now catching up. We're catching up to that cost now about how to do things differently. But unless that's forced, I really don't have faith that the human race is capable of actually changing voluntarily what we do, instead of continuing to degrade our own life support systems in the process of kind of killing off the planet.
I wish we had 2 hours and we don't, but because there's a lot more to talk about. We're beginning to run a little short of time, but I can tell you, if nature has rights and human beings are part of nature, I can see pro-lifers saying, wait a second, if forests have the right to life, why not unborn babies? And bring a lawsuit under a nature rights theory to stop abortion.
Well, they already tried, because, of course, you have these laws floating around in which from conception, people have argued that the fetus is a person, from the time of conception. So it's not like we invented the concept of rights for nature, rights of nature. Other people have been using these concepts to push the universe of personhood for a longer time than we have. But I think the way that it's being used for nature's rights is much different, again, than the anthropocentric way that rights have generally been used to expand out, rights to exploit on behalf of humans, especially in the realm of the natural environment.
Couldn't nature rights actually harm responsible environmental policies? For example, windmills kill millions of birds. They kill bats. They kill insects. Why couldn't someone... But we're told we need the windmills because of climate change, and we need to have renewable energy that doesn't produce carbon emissions. But why couldn't a bird lover say, wait a second, I'm going to shut down this entire windmill farm, this electric generation, because of the birds? I mean, it could actually harm the environment as opposed to help it.
Yeah, so you've had that happen already. Most people, when they think about windmills, they think about, oh, one windmill in the middle of some place that, you know, is providing energy that's free of the climate impacts and implications, those types of things. In New Hampshire, what they do when they want to put in a wind farm, an industrial wind farm, is they blow the tops off of mountains. They flatten the tops of the mountains, and then they put 50 windmills up that do some of the bad things that we've been talking about. So I think there's a real argument there, actually. That the way in which we try to move towards a green energy future has to have some rules to it. And those rules will end up changing how we do that production, how we actually implement those types of things.
You're going to have a tremendous reduction in the ability to generate electricity because supposedly, I know that nature rights has been used to want to bring lawsuits about fossil fuels because it's warming the climate, it causes pollution and so forth. So we get rid of the fossil fuels, we get rid of the wind farms, we get rid of the hydroelectric dams. I assume that nature rights people wouldn't like nuclear power because if there's a meltdown, there could be a catastrophic environmental impact. What do we have left?
Well, funny you should ask. One thing we have left is to use less energy.
Uh-huh.
And to live within our means. Because if we can't develop these other energy sources without interfering with forms of life on the planet or with our own life support systems in terms of clean air and clean water, we really have to learn to live within our own means.
You are talking about a collapse of economies, and you are talking about basically turning humans into hunter-gatherers and probably not hunters.
Well, I don't think we're going to go back to living in caves and striking stones together to make fire, but we have certain assumptions that drive this Western European system, which is that endless economic growth is possible, that endless economic growth is necessary to freedom, liberty, and prosperity. And those assumptions are going to run us into the grave. And they're starting to now. We have the warning signals coming back for the last 10, 15, 20 years. That those assumptions are a suicide pact in themselves, that we cannot continue with those assumptions and build the type of world that's actually supportive of human and other life. That's basically where we end up. So what's funny is when you pluck the thread of rights of nature, gets you into all of these other issues, most of which come back to what's our worldview, what are our assumptions that we make to support that worldview, and where do we believe humanity is headed? And do we have faith that humanity can somehow voluntarily constrain our population, voluntarily constrain our energy use? I happen to believe that that's not possible, that we are one of the dumbest species on the planet and that we like to break everything and then try to figure out a way to make money out of fixing it. I don't think we can do that here.
I think this is an anti-capitalistic movement. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, I think capitalism has its own problems, but if capitalism means basically those who have the most amount of capital can buy the most amount of nature and then destroy the most amount of nature, which it seems like that's the system which we're in, then I would say, yes, it's anti-capitalism.
Have you been to China and breathed the air in China?
No, but I breathe the air in Los Angeles, which was some of the same air that you
even
breathe.
LA in my childhood isn't what China is. You can smell the coal soot.
Yeah, in Kathmandu, in Nepal, you can do the same thing. But again, I think that's evidence that we need a new system because existing environmental laws, to the extent that they exist in those places, are not functioning.
Well, China has, let's say, 1.3 billion people. Mm-hmm. It doesn't recognize human rights. It engages in genocide. What makes you think it would ever, ever grant rights to nature?
Well, I don't think it will, at least in the short term. I think that means really having something binding at the international level that allows for enforcement downwards.
Good luck. And
I think what you're seeing now, there's a new UN resolution that's being drafted by some indigenous communities in the U.S. to put forward at the United Nations level. But that's one possibility. The other one is that eventually we run up against our own limits. And China, in fact, with some of the air quality stuff, has now started to seriously take some air quality issues because it's affecting production and industrial activity. And so I think that's kind of one of the constraints that we run up against where people have to start caring about these things.
It strikes me that if the Western civilization, Europe, U.S., New Zealand, Australia, so forth, adopt nature rights, and the Soviet Union and China and probably India, although India has some of that going on, don't, then the locus of power, which is often based on economic might, will shift to totalitarian regimes, and there'll be less freedom.
Well, there's another way to look at that, which is that if...
We should have less freedom, right? Is that what you're saying?
Perhaps less property-oriented right to extract kind of freedoms. But when you turn that over on its head, you know, China is a leading solar producer now and is a leading renewable energy producer of technology and equipment now. They found a way to make a living off of living within constraints.
But that requires mining lithium and things like that. And
Absolutely.
Environmental activists try to stop the mining of lithium.
Absolutely. And lithium mining is not one of the high points of Western civilization either, to be applauded. But eventually we come to a place where we have to decide, are we going to live on this planet in a sustainable way? Or are we going to live on this planet in an unsustainable way? And we have thrown our lot in with unsustainability. The kind of technologies and equipment evolution that has to take place for us to figure out how to live sustainably on the planet, that's a whole industry in itself. You know, going all the way back to Al Gore talking about, you know, putting the U.S. in the lead in terms of being a leader in these kinds of sustainability technologies. So
the same Al Gore who flies private planes and has multiple houses.
Yeah, well, we all have. Who's the poet that said we have multiple contradictions within ourselves? Something like that. But then again, his daughter got arrested trying to stop a fossil fuel project in Massachusetts. So, you know, there's life is complicated. But we either find a way to live on the planet that doesn't destroy our own life support systems and the life around us, or we don't. That's our question. If we're always driven by who has the upper hand in economic production, we're destined to go down a very dark road, I think.
It seems to me the nature rights movement, and we're out of time, so we'll have to call. I want to do some more of this. One of the things that it, I think, tacitly acknowledges is that human beings have an obligation to assume very, in your view, in my view, but your view necessary, my view, draconian duties for the other, whether it's forests or whatever. Doesn't that demonstrate that we are exceptional since only we have the capacity to do that? Elephants can destroy whole ecosystems on their own and nobody would hold that against them because they don't have any moral obligations. We do. So aren't you tacitly acknowledging at least that human beings are exceptional in our natures? And then that gives us, you and I would say different, argue for different levels of duties, but we're the only ones that have them.
I'll give you this. Humans passing rights of nature laws are proving themselves to be exceptional. that they're capable of actually recognizing a new rights construct for nature, which in itself is a voluntary restriction on their own activities, things like extraction. If the human race is able to kind of accept those restrictions and move into a new age, that to me would prove that the human race was exceptional. But also in your China example, just to go back to that, China, that's like arguing that human rights in the U.S. are an impediment to production and economic production. That
they are sometimes.
If we just got rid of human rights here, that we could compete better with China because China has a different playing field than we do from an economic perspective. So right. you could apply the same argument to that we should get rid of our human rights protections because those are an impediment to our economic production competitiveness with places.
Yeah, but I would actually argue, and again, I'm sorry we're out of time, you know, that democratic freedoms lead to cleaner environment than despotism and authoritarianism.
When allowed to pass laws based on those democratic majorities, I would agree completely with you. But in the U.S., we have communities that are restrained and constrained from passing laws that are commensurate with that protection of the environment because they're overridden by other rights. And I think that may be one area where we agree on some things, is that power of lawmaking and democratic local self-government needs to be released in some ways. In the
Well, let's end on an area of agreement. I'd like to have you back probably next year with an expert in environmental law that supports the current paradigm that could do a better job than I could of discussing that, if you'd agree. And yeah. So let's end now. What next for Thomas Lindsay?
Writing a book on the state of American democracy. And
well, we were just talking about that.
Right. The title of the book is going to be American Democracy and Other Fairy Tales.
You are such a cynic.
To talk about basically as a memoir of my experience with democratic local self-government and how it's been curtailed in the United States.
Maybe we'll talk about that too.
Yeah, that'd be great.
All right. Thomas, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to Humanize from Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism, where human rights meet human responsibilities. Discover all the good work of the Center on Human Exceptionalism by visiting discovery.org/human. We can only do this work, speaking on behalf of human life, human thriving, and our exceptional place in this world and our cosmos, with your support. We invite you to make a one-time gift today and to consider starting a monthly gift to support the Center on Human Exceptionalism and this show. Wherever you're listening to Humanize, please take a moment to rate and review the show. You matter. Your actions matter. Be bold, be exceptional, and be back soon.